Welcome to the PDH online audio course on electrical engineering for jails, electrical design tests, part 1. Electrical power service for a jail closely follows the standard service for a large facility, as shown in the graphic in the written version. In this graphic, we have a little V at the top that shows the utility distribution system, which is none of our business. I emphasize that because the utility doesn't really want to tell you what they've got going on out there. A lot of the books you'll read will talk about doing your protective analysis for your facility, and this is a jail or any place else, by including the protective devices on the utility side. If you talk to the utility representative, you'll find they do not promise to maintain their system the way they tell you it is. And for that reason, they often won't tell you how it is. Assume an infinite bus out there because they can parallel things and reduce impedance considerably. So we have a little V at the top to indicate the utility is doing whatever the utility does out there. When we do our analysis, you may or you may ignore their available short circuit capacity. Again, I call it an infinite bus because you can't get in trouble when you do that. I'm showing a utility transformer. I am not familiar with any recent day cases where the customer has purchased the transformer. The reason for that is we don't have a stock of transformers. If we have a transformer problem, I agree it's rare, but if we have a transformer problem, we got a real serious problem unless we can find a friend who has a similar transformer and is willing to put it in on an emergency basis while we figure out what we're going to do about it. Utility has a yard full of transformers. If you've driven by their service facilities, I mean, truly, they have a yard full of transformers. Now, I know in today's day and age, they're trying to reduce stock and all that good stuff. But again, if they put in a lot of 500 kVA pad mounts, they're going to have a few of them sitting around. I mean, that's just sensible on their side. So you want them to own the transformer, regardless of anything anybody tells you. I'm showing metering on the utility side of the demarcation. They've changed the rules lately. It used to be they cared a lot about their metering, and they installed their metering. Today, they insist the customer install the feeders from the transformer into the building. The customer install whatever's needed for the metering, except the meter itself. If it requires current transformers because it's a large service, then you buy the current transformers, to their specification, of course. But you buy the transformers, you buy the meter, the box for the CTs, and you buy the meter base, and they'll plug the meter into it. I'm thinking some utilities like to provide their own CTs, but you still provide the box. And they like to coordinate with the contractor who's pulling the cable because they really don't want trouble with it. They're short on manpower, but they watch what's going on. I'm showing on the customer side of the demarcation now a main circuit breaker. I like main circuit breakers. Now, a lot of people put in main fuses, and I think this is from the old days when circuit breakers had a failure record. You don't hear much about circuit breaker failures today. In the old days, you did. I mean, it was just a fact of life, but it's not much today. And there are problems with fuses. I don't want to get into the fuse circuit breaker argument, but there are problems with fuses. Now, fuses are excellent coordination devices. There are things that are possible with fuses that you just can't consider with circuit breakers. But the quick, the easy, the reliable, the pull it out of your back pocket and do it and move on to the rest of the job solution is to put in a circuit breaker. I typically put in a circuit breaker panel with a service entrance rated main and a bunch of branch breakers. Why do we do that? Because it's cheap and easy, and there are some advantages that are not obvious. And I think we get into this in another course in PDH Online. What you try to do is keep your service to a manageable size. The National Electric Code lets you have as many as 6 services to a facility, and there are ways to go beyond that if you want to, but 6 is a big number. That means that it's pretty easy for a jail to run it off 1,000 or 2,000 amp service, or 2 2,000 amp services or three 2,000 amp services. You can see that's a lot of current coming in. And I'm not making a big deal about whether it's 208 or 480. You do pretty much what the utility tells you to do. And if they only have 208 in the area, that's what you're going to do. And we don't get into a problem on chillers running on 208. They do that in shopping centers all the time. You can do it in a jail, too. I'm showing service grounding system. I'm not detailing that. That's almost a specialty within engineering, and it's well covered in the National Electric Code course that PDH Online offers. We get into the main distribution panel, which may be integrable with the main disconnect or maybe a separate panel. I'm showing a row of circuit breakers because, again, I like circuit breakers. Each of them has a feeder cable going out to a branch panel. The branch panels are labeled HVAC, kitchen, lighting, receptacles, and it's indicated that there can be a very large number of these. A note on this drawing, emergency egress lighting provided by local battery packs. Now, once again, that's not the only way to do it. In my opinion, there are a lot of good reasons that's the only way you should consider. First off, they're cheap. Any problem with it, you rip it off the wall and throw it away. I mean, you don't have to bring in a service technician and pay mileage charges and pay for a high-powered guy with special instruments. You just rip it off and put in a new one. The drawing is entitled Typical Electrical Service One-Line Diagram. The electric utility brings in power to distribution voltage. I'm saying here 13.2 kV, but sometimes 4.16 kV. And there are some other strange numbers, 13.2, 13.8. What's the difference between them? There is a difference, but it's not obvious to the layman. 14.4 is another voltage that's about the same, but not quite the same. I've seen places with 39 kV service. They're giving distribution service, and that means you need bigger, different rated transformers. But again, in our situation, the utility is supplying the transformer. We don't care much what they do, or even if they come back later and change it, except for the difficulties of the period while we don't have utility service. Utility provides the transformer. Today, the utility normally requires the customer to provide the secondary conductors and meter box, but the revenue meter is owned by the utility. If there are current transformers for meter, they are provided by the utility. Yes, I'm thinking of Detroit because I just finished a job in Detroit, and that's what they did. We put in the box, and they put in the CTs. But the contractor provides CT enclosure. Contractor meaning working for the owner. Paid for by the owner. The transformer secondary voltage may be 480Y 277 volts with additional transformation within the facility to 208 120V, or the utility may deliver at 208 120V, and that's fine. Large HVAC chillers can operate at 480 or 208. I don't mean that. What I mean is you can buy them at 480, or you buy it totally different at 208. I haven't seen reconnectable big chillers with little difference in cost or performance. The customer must provide a service entrance rated disconnect switch, mostly for fire department use, and I think you can visualize the need there. Firefighters come in there. They do not want things to come back up the water stream at them, but also to isolate the building during maintenance. Main distribution panel protects the wiring to each of the branch panels. And again, we've got main distribution panel, circuit breaker, feeder, and then branch panel out at the end of it. Branch panels provide electricity to the circuits which power devices in the facility. In the example we talked about, we had a branch panel in each of the utility rooms out by the pods. I'm sure there was a panel in the kitchen. You just always put a separate kitchen panel. If you don't, when the refrigeration units in the kitchen kick on, the lights dim. But you run them a separate panel, you don't have any problem with that. And again, anything else of substantial size, give them their own panel. It's nice to put critical circuits on panels. In a commercial installation or a school or a church or something like that, critical circuits, You can see them. I mean, you look at the project and say, hey, there's a couple critical circuits. Let's run them off a common panel. In hospitals, in jails, in life safety situations, sometimes you invest considerable effort in identifying the critical circuits and putting in panels for them, because you're going to switch it over to the generator. And if you follow the law, you're going to put in a load shedding scheme so that other people get switched off and the critical circuits don't get switched off. Note that emergency egress lighting is provided by local battery packs, that is, battery-operated lights, which are recharged by normal power and come on automatically on the interruption of normal power. Now, I'm carefully choosing my words here. Normal power, not utility power, because when we switch on to our generator, and we're going to have a generator for a jail, that's normal power. It's an emergency generator because the National Electric Code calls it an emergency generator. But they are not emergency circuits. They are normal power circuits because we're running normal operations of the facility off that source. It's a secondary source to the facility. It is not an emergency generator, and it's not qualified for life safety application. Now, this is a hard idea for some people to get their heads around, especially facility managers. They've called them emergency generators all their lives, and they put them in places to save money on battery packs. And why aren't they emergency generators? Well, because you're running the facility on a normal basis. It's not 90 minutes to walk out. It's forever and ever until the utility power comes back on. So you still need emergency egress lights separate from your generator power. For a jail, the service and distribution one-line diagram would be modified as follows. And we're going to find out about that generator and a couple minor changes that are required by the presence of the generator. We shouldn't talk about the utility side. We've got their distribution system that's their secret providence. We've got their transformer, which, again, they can change out at will. One of the interesting things about utility transformers, I love this. I think this is just the greatest joke there ever was. The electrical engineer sits there, and he totals up his KVA, and he does all this stuff for the plans review submission, gives it to the utility. And the utility looks at it, puts a red line through it, and gives him one half or one quarter the transformer that he asked for. Why is that? Because the National Electric Code calculations are so conservative that you get stuff double-sized, triple-sized, quadruple-sized from what it really needs. Also, the utility has a totally different mindset. They don't mind overloading their equipment. Glows red hot, that's okay as long as it doesn't sag into the next conductor below it. If they're both glowing red hot, they'll both sag and we got no problem. And really, that's the way the utility guys think. I shouldn't go on and on with this box narrative, but I love this stuff. Forgive me for sharing it with you beyond any reasonable level. My boss used to work for a utility. I mean, he was high up in the utility. Went through a lot of jobs in the utility to move up that way. Well, we had a problem at a church we were doing. And I looked at it, and another designer done the job. I said, well, he followed the utility, and that was a mistake. The utility had a 100 kVA transformer, so he put in a 100 kVA transformer. Well, how's that a problem? Well, the utility, and this is from the old days, they had an oil-filled transformer in the basement of the church. And my friend, the designer, actually the loads went down in the church. My friend, the designer, put in 100 kVA dry type. Well, 100 kVA dry type transformer is not the same as 100 kVA oil-filled. 100 kVA oil-filled has something like 150% overload rating. 100 kVA dry type has no overload rating at all. It starts cooking the insulation, reducing the service life severely in any overload, short-term overload. And he was tripping circuit breakers. So we put in a bigger circuit breaker, and the problem went away. But the thing was way too hot to touch. And the church didn't like that, and the contractor didn't like that. So we ended up going back and changing it out to I think 150 kVA, which was kind of exciting, trying to get the 150 kVA through this door in the basement. But that's a totally another story. But the point was, my boss firmly believed that the utility had protected that transformer, that there's no way that transformer could have been operating in an overload region. And I said, No, the utility runs them to failure. They do not protect them. Well, he was offended that the little guy, me, was telling the big guy, him, how his former employer did it. So he checked with some of his buddies, and the thing was protected for 100 amps incoming, but it was 100 amps at 4160. They had short circuit protection only. They had no overload protection. And obviously, when we put in overload protection, it started tripping out with exactly the same load. So, we don't look at the utility transformer. We do not look at the utility distribution. And we look at the metering only to the extent that we have to provide facilities for it. Or if we're one of the good guys, we put in some check metering. We have a course in PDH Online that talks about check metering. I don't remember which course it is. There are inexpensive check meters. I'm talking $500 to monitor three-phase what's coming into the facility. The reason I like this is I like to be able to look at the volts that are coming in. I mean, if the utility's giving us bad electricity, let's not worry too much about what our problems are inside. I like to look at the amps that are coming in. If we have humongous, unbelievable amps, that kind of goes along with the bad voltage, but that means it's on our side of the demarcation. I like to look at the KV, the accumulated kilowatts, and all that kilowatt hours and the good stuff that you get off a meter. For $500, you can put in a real nice three-phase multimeter, you know, volts, amps, kilowatts, KVA, with storage and with Modbus communications. It's hard to get local area network Ethernet communications. Possible, but it's difficult. But you can get Modbus pretty cheap, and with a little bit of luck, you've got some way you can use that. Service comes into the building just as before, but now it comes into an automatic transfer switch. Now we get into one of the hairy problems. Service entrance rated 4-pole automatic transfer switch. Why service entrance rated? Well, because the first thing where the utility comes into the building, it must be a service-rated device. You can't say, well, my main disconnect's downstream of this. Uh-uh. It is the first thing. It may not be legitimate layer or exactly a disconnect, but it must be a service-rated device. 4-pole. Why 4-pole instead of 3-pole? We've got a course on generators. If this is interesting to you, read that course. If it's not interesting because your salesman's always told you 3-pole is the way to go, go ahead and put in 3-pole. They work. What's wrong with the 3-pole is that it provides a safety hazard for a guy doing maintenance on the generator when it's not on the system. When a 3-pole forces the ground current, you know, the fault current, to go a long way off to the service entrance to get a ground path back to the generator. Whereas a 4-pole permits you to put the grounding directly at the generator. And we've got the main disconnect and our service entrance grounding and all that good stuff. Now, there's a change in the distribution down in the main distribution panel. I'm showing undervoltage trips on three of the breakers, feeder breakers. The undervoltage trips are on HVAC, kitchen, and general lighting. And let's see what the text here says to explain what's going on. In this representation, no change in the utility side of the service. Some customers feel they receive better reliability by having two different utility sources. The recent Northeast power failure suggested, however, that power failures may be regional rather than narrowly local. If standby service is obtained from the utility, then the utility connection requirements must be met. Now, what we're saying is if you choose to have two utility services, then you got two utility services and a transfer switch. And I hope you still have another transfer switch in the generator, because we learned some things from that Northeast power blackout, I hope. And I haven't seen any changes in the system to improve it. There are extremely high fees for standby power service. The automatic transfer switch and generator are essential for a GEO. The generator is tested monthly per regulations, and the transfer switch connects it to the GEO main panel when utility power is lost. that the design shown utilizes a ground rod at the generator for safety and has a four-pole transfer switch. Each independent power source must have a service entrance rated disconnect. I prefer to require a service entrance rated breaker on the generator because up until recently, generator suppliers tried to avoid giving me any main breaker at all. Now, this isn't all silliness. They have, today at least, electronic regulators and electronic governors. And what that means is when it electronically senses a problem, it releases the generator from the system. It doesn't drive fault current into the system. So it has protective devices, even though it doesn't have a circuit breaker. But again, code says circuit breaker. I like circuit breakers. I have a real good feeling about a circuit breaker as a disconnect. I do not have a good feeling about electronic device, and you know, that's just affecting the field voltage to protect the generator. And I don't like non-load break related devices. Say again, a circuit breaker is a honest to goodness protective device, both in automatic operation and in manual operation. From where I come from, you don't get the same level of protection for people or for the system from the electronic devices. When you talk about the code requirement for service entrance, this helps you fight to get that breaker that the generator guy doesn't want to supply. Of course, having both incomings of the automatic transfer switch be SE rated also meets the requirements. I was just reading a report from one of the funding agencies, and they were recommending outboard breakers up to 500 kVA, was it? And integral, that is, within the automatic transfer switch above that. They'd done an analysis that it was cheaper that way. And again, that's fine, but recognize you need service entrance rated devices for each electrical source entering the building. That is, the utility source and the generator source. Generator source must have SE rated interrupting device. By having the HVAC, kitchen, and general lights trip off with a power interruption and not come back until manually reset, permits a smaller generator while maintaining locking systems and CCTV without massive battery packs. Thought I talked here about the generators. Once again, we've got an entire generator course. What's wrong with a big generator is that it runs lightly loaded. I mean, obviously, if you're putting a lot of capacity in there, it's going to have unused capacity. If you size it a little closer, and I'm not saying down to a gnat's eyebrow, but if you size it a little closer, it runs harder. And they say things like 60 to 80% is the desirable operating point on a generator. When you do less than that, you get maintenance problems. Again, this is discussed in the generator course, or if you want to just talk to your generator salesman. The other thing is, and people don't realize this till they get into trouble, you got a big generator, you got to have a big fuel tank. I mean, obviously, you're not looking for 90 minutes operation so everybody can walk out of your jail. You want to keep them in that jail. So what do you want? I mean, is your design basis 24-hour interruption? Is your design basis 3-day interruption? It becomes a big fuel tank. And obviously, with a big generator, it's a lot bigger fuel tank. Well, old fuel oil turns bad, and it turns bad in a way that it's classified as a hazardous waste. So what people have been discovering is, if they were real careful and put in a big generator and a big fuel tank, they got a big fuel tank of hazardous waste that they have to pay a special contractor to haul off and burn. Sounds like it ought to burn pretty good, but it has nasty things in it. Now, another thing, when I was putting this together, I was thinking, we used to filter transformer oil with Fuller's Earth to take the nasties out of the transformer oil. And I'll bet you could filter this fuel oil, too. But let's try to avoid it. Let's try to put in a moderate-sized generator, a moderate-sized fuel oil tank, and maybe run the thing a couple times a year to reduce our electric bill and use up the oil and buy some new oil. Electrical power distribution within a jail is identical to that for a shopping center or school or church, with three exceptions. Locking systems, CCTV, and communications are life safety items within the meaning of NFPA 70, National Electric Code, Article 700. What this means is that a serious hazard to human life results from loss of power to these systems. NFPA 70 is the National Electric Code and is enforced by the local Building Standards Department through building permits and inspections during construction. Provisions of Article 700 include totally separate wiring from non-life safety systems and provision for a second source of power when normal power is lost. Note that emergency lighting is not included in this discussion. Emergency lighting is always a life safety item and is installed per code in shopping centers, schools, churches, and jails. The required second source for the life safety system's egress lighting is a battery pack in the unit. So even when the generator trips off, you still got 90 minutes to evacuate the building. Or in a jail, it's more common to evacuate from a problem section, one bad pod, to another pod and have everybody standing around the day room. You don't usually open the outside doors. Normal lighting for a jail environment is a special concern. There are four essential requirements. First, that it be vandal resistant. 8 or 10 gauge steel. Now, if you're familiar with steel ratings, that's heavy steel. 14-gauge steel is called code gauge. That's what you have to put on electrical panels and junction boxes and stuff like that. And we're down to 8 or 10-gauge for these lighting fixtures. Pin Allen head or pin Torx screws to put the thing together. They just don't come out easy without the right tools. Mounting must be extra secure. That is, you don't rip it off the wall. Hopefully, there's nothing to grab a hold of, so you could pull it off. You slip off first, and if you were able to get a grip for some reason, it's so anchored into the wall, it doesn't come off. You hang from it. Reminds me of high school kids hanging from the lighting fixtures in the locker room. We go to some trouble to mount them securely also. And they tend to hang from them, too. There's a PDH course on schools if you'd like to. Second, it can provide no hold points for sheets to be used for suicide. This is becoming more and more a concern. Used to be, a lot of people didn't care if the patients committed suicide. But recently, a lot of people have been discovering that people we're calling prisoners or offenders are mentally ill. And the suicide is not a good solution for the problems, and it's not consistent with the way our society approaches these problems. I've seen special handicapped handrails that are closed. Now, if you can think of a closed handrail, that is a difficult concept, so that sheets cannot be tied to them. Third, lighting levels are defined by national jail standards. It is not hard to reach them. We're going to get into that in a moment. But it's not reached in most existing, let's say pre-1990 jails. Enough light to get around was all you needed. You didn't need enough light to read. Well, they're starting to enforce these jail standards, and now you have to have enough light to read. Fourth, that maintenance be rapid. Maintenance men do not like to spend time in the high security section. What you want is a situation where they run their little power gun, whirr, and that Torx pin screw drops out, and flip, the door comes open, and snap, snap, the two quarter turn fasteners are loose, the thing drops down by an electrical connector, you jerk it off, pick up the new one, jerk on the power connector, snap, snap the sub base with the ballast and the lights into the thing, flip up the cover, whirr, 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 and it's all done. The guy's out in 5 minutes. Makes them very happy. I think it's a good installation. These are the features of modern security fixtures. One precinct house insisted on lamp change without entering the cell. What they had was a hardened glass globe into the cell with an Edison base in the utility corridor outside the cell. And the maintenance man would go down the utility corridor, flip out the Edison base, change the bulb, and flip it back in. Also, they did not have lighting levels sufficient for reading. Catalog sheets for two manufacturers of security lighting follow. Now, there's a lot of detail on this, and it's interesting. It's not interesting to the point that you need to memorize details of what makes a good security fixture, but it's interesting to see that there is an industry out there that supplies the needs of the detention industry. I'm showing two of these. I suggest you go to the internet when you get a spare moment and just look at the cut sheets because they are interesting. The first is Jail Lighting Fixtures, http://cooperlighting.com/specfiles/product-info/FCC-PDF. So this is an FCC fixture from Cooper Lighting. Doesn't say Cooper Lighting anywhere on the spec sheet, except you get down to the reference for it. It says Failsafe. That was probably a separate company that made very good fixtures, and Cooper Lighting bought them. FCC has nothing to do with the Federal Communications Commission. It is now let me describe this properly for you. Got the idea of a box. Well, the box is the cell. Where the wall and the ceiling come together is a long corner. Well, this is a fixture that fits in the long corner. In a moment, we're going to do some light level calculations. We're going to use two of these fixtures. The one I picked out uses 3 32-watt linear fluorescent tubes, just like the F-40s of the old days, except now they're F-32s because the government's helping us. It's available with a lot of different lamps. I like the F-32 because it gives you a good lighting level. They have excellent lifespan, they're economical being a commodity item. There's just an awful lot of things in favor of it. Three lamps gives you a lot of light, and also you can do some even odd switching on light levels if you want to get involved in that. So the first one we're looking at is Cooper Lighting. Failsafe is their in-house brand, and the model is FCC, which is corner mounted in the wall ceiling corner. There are also some fixtures that mount in the wall ceiling corner. You know what I'm talking about? A lot of times we see elevator closed circuit cameras mounted in that corner. Well, you can also get lights that mount in that corner. And boy, do they do a bad job. I mean, just everything interferes with the light pattern because from that corner, the bunk's in the way, the sink's in the way. There's no place you can sit and get enough light to read. Second unit, and I'm not going to say they're identical. Boy, they sure look identical, though. Well, this one is from Kennal, K-E-N-A-L-L, and it's called a Model CC, and corner mount surface. They say compact linear fluorescent. You can get compact tubes in this. You can get the F-32 that I like in it also. And it's got the three tubes, and it's got the quick mount, and it's got the pin Torx, pin Allen screws. Just a real nice fixture. Not cheap. Nobody would confuse this with cheap. Let's see if it says here what the metal is that goes into it. I'm not finding it on this one, but it's going to be husky. It's the kind of thing, if you have a loose chair and you wang it with a loose chair, it smiles and keeps on working. Doesn't dent, might scratch. There's very little choice in the type and location of cell lighting. Center ceiling, corner wall ceiling, and corner fixtures are available. I like the corner wall ceiling because they are extremely robust, give acceptable light levels, and distribution. Below are the distributions for an installation of two fixtures per cell, each with 3 32-watt linear fluorescence. Compact fluorescents are very popular in this application as well. Particular fixture shown has a speaker grill option. It's kind of interesting. Simplifies overall design of the facility. And I got a box, which again is the cell. I think this is 7x9 if I remember how this goes together. We've got two of the fixtures along one of the sidewalls. And with low reflectance walls, we're getting light levels from 20 to 24, actually 25 foot candles directly under the fixture. The same installation with high reflectance walls. High reflectance walls are recommended. I just thought it was interesting to see what effect the paint had to do on the place. 30-foot candles directly under the fixture. 30-foot candles in the center of the room. It looks like they've done some engineering on the
light patterns that come out of this. 24-foot candles in the far corners. So nice distribution, nice light level. You can read anywhere in that room. I'd call that a real good design. Today, almost everyone is aware of the problems of a momentary interruption of power, such as when a jail is transferred from utility source to generator source. Every computer reboots, unless it has an uninterruptible power source, UPS. Locking systems have a computer. New CCTV systems have a computer. Communication systems have a computer. And we all wait while they reboot. And I'm going to tell you this, and I'm going to try not to comment on it. All of the new systems run on Windows. I was raised on Unix. Well, that's because that's before they invented Windows. I was raised on Unix, and we liked Unix. There were a lot of good things about Unix. There are some old guys still around, and they've raised a few young people that feel the same way, that Unix is still a good operating system. There are even a few people out there who will say Unix is simple. I'm not one of those. But if you buy yourself a VCR, if you buy yourself a digital video recorder, if you buy yourself a network video recorder, almost exclusively, you're buying a Windows PC that has some special software, possibly some special hardware. Well, Windows PCs do not reboot fast. I mean, when everything's right and they're new, they don't reboot fast. And after they've had all kinds of problems and been patched and fixed and downloaded service packs, they can take a long, long time to reboot. That's not good in a jail. So we put in a UPS and hope that when we transfer to generator, we've got 10 seconds of power to keep the thing running. Even a UPS that's old and sick should be able to give us 10 seconds of power during the automatic transfer switch transfer. Locking systems provide the best control of the facility. Now, that's arguable perhaps, but that's my opinion. While they are intact, problems stay within the jail. Locking systems should be designed for primary mechanical locking and supervisory electrical locking. Obviously, we're getting real heavy into personal opinion on this. And let's be honest, the architect chooses this stuff. The electrical engineer doesn't anyhow. Architect picks out the locking systems. All we do are connect wires to whatever he chose. That means the right key will always lock or unlock the door. And if you haven't seen some of these security keys, they are impressive. They're big, heavy keys. You don't take one home at the end of the day by accident. The motor on the motorized locking can be used to lock or unlock the door from the control room. Motorized locks tend to fail in their last position, but fail-safe and fail-secure options are available. Fail-safe means, in the old days, it used to be a good idea to get out of a building when something bad happened. That's what fail-safe means, that you can open the door. Fail-secure means, a lot of times in a jail, you want to keep a door locked, so that's called fail-secure. Bolt position switch will not report status without power, and the computer and the door position switch will not report status without power and the computer. So even though we've got manual locks on this, without the power, without the computer, we don't know for sure whether we left them in the locked or the open position. A lot of times during the day, they group open the locks to the cell so people can go back to their room, get their stuff, go on, play cards or whatever you do in the day room, and they just leave all the doors unlocked. Well, if you have an emergency and you lose your electronic locking systems, you don't know if they're locked or unlocked. Prisoner areas should be safe from the mechanical side of the locks, but the control rooms will not have indication status. Also, it's been observed that the mechanical locking systems may not be reliable, making the status indicators more critical, if that is possible. And that was a true statement. I hope you take it seriously. But it means the result more than it means the words it says. Mechanical locking system may not be reliable. Doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the mechanical lock. It means there's something wrong with the wiring up to the mechanical lock. Selection of mechanical locks is an architectural responsibility. There are many other forms and options than indicated here. If you wish to follow up on this, Folger Adam, I'm being careful. Let's try to be careful with the terms here. Folger Adam, not Folger Adams, catalog is available at southernsteel.com, catalog form .shtml. Southern Steel bought Folger Adam, and I think in the current catalog it still says Folger Adam, but it is Southern Steel or Southern Folger. The interesting thing about this is apparently when they bought Folger Adam, they didn't buy the whole company, they just bought parts of it. So there's another company out there that does something different called Folger Adam. They sell residential and industrial electric strikes, which you might call door security, but I don't call door security within a correctional institution sense. They're trying hard to be door security, but they're not maximum level doing good. Now, what I was about to say was, you can get in and see their catalog. And the first time I did that, I thought, that's kind of interesting. What if I was a bad guy and I wanted to see how the locks are put together so I can open them? And all you have to do is give your name and affiliation. It lets you into their catalog. They did not give the wiring diagram on the motorized locks, which, and I wrote them a letter, talked to their local rep, asked for the wiring diagram. Haven't heard anything yet. So maybe they are careful about what they consider critical. Got a graphic in the written version of this thing showing a door. Door's got hinges, door's got locks. The hinges are shown a little bigger than normal. Typically, in a correctional facility, they are pretty big husky hinges. The lock is a little bigger than normal. It's oversized in the graphic representation, but in fact, they're about 10 inches by 8 inches. I mean, pretty big locks. This is a mortise lock that goes in the door with a bolt, usually a big bolt, sticking out that latches into the door jamb. And I'm showing a key set on the door because that's what I'm recommending, is a motorized mechanical lock. Shows a motor to drive the thing and a bolt position switch. So the motorized lock knows whether the bolt is extended or retracted. And using the switch, it can send this back to the locking system's console. The wires go through the door, as you would expect. Then they go up to an electric hinge. I've been calling this an electric hinge for about 30 years. When I got into the catalog to verify this information for you, I found they're called electric transport hinges. Now, that makes a little more sense because it's the wires are going through the hinge to get to the other side of the hinge. That's transport. But normally, transport has something to do with trucks. So I'm not sure. Electric transport hinge is a much better word than electric hinge. By the way, you try and buy these things, people know what you're talking about. You call up the hardware supplier, takes care of the jail, and say, one of my electrical hinges is bad. And they say, yeah, you got two kinds out there. Which one is it? You know. So electric hinge is a common discussion term. And a door position switch. Now, I'm showing a micro switch. We're not supposed to say micro switch anymore. Micro switch used to be a Honeywell trademark. Honeywell's been buying and selling things. I don't know if it's Honeywell anymore, but I know we're not supposed to say micro switch. But you know what I mean. A little thing with either a button sticking out, or I like the ones with kind of an arm with a roller at the end of it. And then there is a pin that sticks out into the jamb. When the door is closed, it presses the pin. The pin presses the tiny switch. What's nice about these switches I'm talking about, limit switches, is that they're rated for things like 250,000 operations. They don't wear out. They're industrial duty units, and they're actually industrial duty for real nasty environments. So they look little and flimsy, but they are extremely robust. If they're installed in a concealed location, as we're suggesting here, they last forever. You don't have trouble with your limit switch. Application of life safety egress rules is an architectural responsibility. However, it's common to have an electrical renovation without an architect on the team. First choice is to consult an architect to make sure the immediate job complies with current rules and interpretations. Second choice is to replace the existing system in a way that duplicates the original design intent. Now, let me go just a little bit further. you've got to negotiate with your client, with your project manager, what you're going to do on this. The law permits a range of responses. You want to have an installation that everybody buys into, that they don't look for the designer to explain to the judge why it's that way. Everybody agreed to have it that way, and it says in the meeting minutes that everybody agreed to have it that way. There is a rule you can use on renovation jobs that if it's a direct one-for-one replacement, you don't have to upgrade to the current rules. Like, you're allowed to do maintenance on items and use the old item rather than use the new item. Now, there are provisions for this, and it's not 100% true, but it's pretty good that if you're not doing any thinking, you don't have to do any thinking. Is that a good idea? Well, the reason they changed the rules is almost certainly because somebody got killed. I mean, that's the incentive to change the rules. Do you want that to happen? Do you want to be in a situation where you have to explain to the judge why you didn't use the latest rules? So there's an incentive also to find out what the latest rules are. Have an architect on the team, or at least consult with an architect to find out what the rules are that apply to this. Second choice is to replace the existing system in a way that duplicates the original design intent. Common interpretation of life safety egress rules by architects I have spoken with, and the interpretation of high-level administrators in correctional institutions, is that we keep the doors locked during an emergency. Once again, keep the jail problem inside the jail. Now, the correctional officer on duty should have the option of opening the outside doors, but I think he doesn't want to do so either unless it's a very extreme situation. If prisoners must be evacuated, it will be a conscious act of control of the control room officers or local officers with keys. There will be no automatic release of locks. This is consistent with the design basis that locking systems are life safety systems, and an officer will be on duty 24/7. Airlocks have been mentioned previously. Now's the time to discuss the components and sequence of operation. We got a graphic here, and it's a very simple thing. It's a corridor. Doesn't have to be short. Usually they are short because you kind of like to watch what's going on in there with closed circuit TV. If it gets too long, you can't see too well on the CCTV what's happening. Nobody ever puts a second camera in. Oh my. At one end of the corridor, there is a sliding door. I like sliding doors rather than swing doors just because typically both sides of the airlock are very busy areas. Sliding door doesn't interfere with other things that are happening in the area as much as a swing door does. One end has a sliding door shown closed. The other end has a sliding door shown closed. There is a CCTV camera inside and an intercom inside. And in the middle of the corridor is something that is not detailed in the sketch called a contraband detector. It's shown as a panel on the right and a panel on the left, and people going through the airlock have to go through it. And obviously, if the contraband detector picks up something bad, it locks the doors and the guard has to manually override it if he wants to let the people through. Certainly, he should talk to him about what's going on in there. Might even want to have another correctional officer come up and go in there and pat him down a little bit. Use one of those wands. In this simplified sketch, the drives for the doors are not shown, nor the door position switches, nor the safeties. You don't like sliding glass doors closing on people and doing damage, so there's usually a safety on it, either a torque switch on the thing that drives it or an edge switch. They have some pneumatic edge switches that are nice, very reliable items too. Might not hold up where people have a serious sense of vandalism on their mind, but again, they're safe and they can be replaced if they are damaged. CCTV camera permits the operator to proceed with providing passage or interrupt the procedure if something appears amiss. Intercom speaker permits the guard to communicate with the visitor. Contraband detector may be as simple as a metal detector, or may incorporate the newer drug and explosive sniffing devices. There are government grants available for the more advanced devices. Now, the technology is not really here for the drug and explosive sniffing. I'm writing this in 2006. By 2008, 2010, it may be off-the-shelf items with a high reliability. it's worth investigating. I mean, the technology does exist in 2006, and the government is helping people install them to see what kind of reliability record they have. Worst thing happens is you jumper the thing out and just watch the people decide if you trust them to come in or not. Airlock sequence of operation. 1, visitor requests entry. The guard requires identification and sign-in. 2, the guard presses door open 1 button. Door 1 opens. Door 1 status light goes red. Red is considered dangerous, and that's an open door in a jail. Visitor enters through door 1. Guard presses door 1 close button. Door 1 closes. Door 1 status light goes green. Green is safe or secure. 5, visitor passes through the contraband detector and no alarm rings. The guard presses door 2 open. Door 2 opens. Door 2 status light goes red. Visitor exits the airlock through door 2. Guard presses door 2 close button. Door 2 closes. Door 2 status light goes green. When there is one door, that is one passageway, and one guard booth, it's simple. But when there are multiple doors, some cell doors, connecting halls, and outside doors, it gets complicated. When there are individual pod control rooms and a master control room, it gets complicated. A simple, obvious, very functional approach is hierarchical control, where only one panel is in control at one time. For our example, the local pod control panels normally operate the cell doors and the connecting doors to the halls. They do not have control of the outside doors, but there are keys available which can override the electric locks and initiate an alarm to the master control room. And the alarm is just that the bolt position doesn't match the command. So that's an alarm that comes out of the thing. If the door opens, there's a door position switch that says the command was to lock the thing and the door is open, you've got a problem out there. It goes red and flashes a little bit at you. Local panel has a green light to indicate that it is in control. Local pod can initiate transfer of control to the master control by hitting a prominent duress button. This sounds an alarm in master control. Local buttons in the pod no longer work. Master control can open and close the cell and hall door locks. Master control can transfer operation back to the pod after communicating with the pod. All transfers are logged on the event recorder function of the PLC HMI system, Programmable Logic Controller, Human-Machine Interface. Without pod control participation, master control can take operation. Now, what that means is master control is sitting up there and they think something funny is going on. They look at the same TV cameras that the pod control looks at. So they flip the switch. They take control from the pod. The pod no longer works. The local buttons no longer work. A local alarm is shown. Master control can open and close the cell and hall doors. And you might want to review the following graphic, which demonstrates the concept. In fact, all the switching is performed by logic inside the PLC. It's kind of interesting. Let me bring this up. This will be a new box narrative. These PLCs are very interesting. They use absolutely garden variety industrial PLCs. Industrial PLCs have wonderful reliability. I mean, just fabulous. These are for steel mills where a mistake sends a hot billet of steel through the end of the building. You know, you don't want that happening. So they have PLCs at very moderate prices that have this level of reliability. But the vendor won't give you the logic for it. And why is that? Because he's responsible for the logic for the warranty period. He doesn't want somebody mucking around with it and then blaming him for it. So he won't even tell you what's in it till the end of the warranty period. He doesn't want to tell you at the end of the warranty period either. He'd rather have you call him back for $500 to look at it if there's a problem. But you do buy the logic inside the controller, and you should get a copy of both the paper listing of the logic that's implemented and electronic listing so that it can be modified easily. The newer PLCs download the program. In the old days, you could upload into the PLC, but you couldn't get it out. I think all of the new PLCs download, so you don't really need the electronic version. You do need the paper version. Paper version will have all the notations of what the switch is used for. Electronic version just tells you there's a switch there. Okay, so we've got a drawing here, and it does not have a PLC. This is the conceptual drawing rather than the physical drawing of the actual system in place. The physical drawing doesn't tell you anything at all. All of the switches come into input terminals. All of the locks come into output terminals, and you don't know what it's doing. You've got to look at the logic diagram, and again, they're a little hard to get a hold of. So what we're showing is master control with a monitor and some push buttons, pod control with a monitor and some push buttons, and a transfer switch. And the control goes up to master control or down to pod control. And the transfer switch is located in master control. So master control decides who has control of the area. Monitoring of the locks goes to both master control and pod control and remains intact. Continuously, it doesn't get interrupted. Sometimes they do like to interrupt it during a duress situation, because assuming there's a bad guy in the control room, you're not going to help him do whatever he's up to, and depriving him of information might be a good idea. Again, this is a local decision, and we're hoping you're going to the trouble to get coordination and buy-in from everybody involved. What happens when there's an alarm has been pretty much codified over the years. An alarm switch closure is received. This is just for example. The event is logged to the archive for later review. It's displayed on the console. It may or may not sound an alarm. The reason I say this, every place I go, they stuff something into the audible alarms, or they put tape over it. People don't seem to like these audible alarms much. The operator presses an acknowledge button. The alarm indication goes from flashing to solid on. Sounder stops, action is logged. So the first thing we do, we hit acknowledge. The operator presses reset. If the alarm contacts have returned to not alarm, then the solid light goes off and the system is ready to receive another alarm. The action is logged. If the contacts are still an alarm, then the solid light stays on. It is considered bad form to have anything in alarm when the operation is turned over at the end of the shift. So you figure out what's going on, get stuff reset before you give it to the next guy. And our only two commands in here are acknowledge and reset. There are other ways to do it, but this is simple and easy and everybody understands it. This is pretty much the standard way of doing it. It may not be obvious what is an alarm. If someone in the pod presses emergency call button, that's an alarm. But also, when locking system command is given to lock a door, and the bolt fully extended limit switch does not make within 5 seconds, that's an alarm. The HMI should have built-in routines which can be invoked for this kind of logic failure. The course is not directed towards details of system programming, but rather towards aiding the writing of performance specifications and acceptance testing. We're ready to get into closed circuit television, and perhaps I should apologize for going into too much on closed circuit television, but it's very interesting to me. I think it's very critical to a proper operation today, and it can be, unfortunately, an area where a lot of money is wasted. So we will spend good portion of an hour talking about closed circuit television and finishing up the course in our next session.